The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it appears that the 2016 election is becoming a real battle over the U.S. Constitution, of all things. Candidates have already been arguing over President Obama overreaching on immigration and health care, and now another constitutional argument over whether the president should actually do what the Constitution says is his duty, to nominate a replacement for the late Associate Justice Antonin Scalia. Republican candidates say it would be wrong for the president to nominate a replacement. It's too close to the election, they say. And the appointments the president has already made during his two terms are radical liberals, and it would be wrong to give him another chance at such a nominee. Republican Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says that he'll block any attempt by President Obama to nominate a Supreme Court justice. Is this a legitimate debate right now? Can we even ask such a question in this anything-goes campaign? And what if senators up for re-election this year? How much of a risk are they taking by lining up to be a part of this Supreme Court blockade? Joining me now is Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So the senators at risk, up for re-election, have they said much about this? Are they keeping their heads down? Are they worried at all?
I don't know if they're worried, but almost all of them have said something, and they have to be worried because this is a big complication with potential risks and potential rewards for re-election all over it, not to mention the presidential, which we, of course, have to talk about. Now, John, you're referring, of course, to the five Republican senators who are defending their seats in states where Barack Obama won twice.
Right.
They're really trying to defend, and this relatively narrow now 54 to 46 Senate majority that Mitch McConnell enjoys that makes him majority leader, that's at stake here in 2016, in addition to all the presidential stuff. So people like Rob Portman in Ohio, Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire, Ron Johnson in Wisconsin, and Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania didn't say anything at first when Mitch McConnell said, not that President Obama can't nominate someone, by the way, but that we won't consider that person and we will block that person. At first, none of them said anything. And since each of them has said, no, I'm on board. This is a good idea. We should wait until there's a new president to consider a new Supreme Court nominee. The stakes are just too high. The fifth person who hasn't said anything substantive about this at all, Mark Kirk, Republican senator of Barack Obama's home state in Illinois, who is in a very tough race for re-election. He hasn't said whether or not he thinks this is a good idea, but he's not going to get the chance to buck it because it looks like Mitch McConnell is going to block any nomination Barack Obama makes, and all the most powerful senators, John, are behind him all that. The most important senator in all of this, of course, is Ted Cruz, the conservative of Texas, who's in a pitch battle with Donald Trump for the presidential nomination.
Well, Cruz is in a battle in the primary right now, and he's playing to the base in the primary election. But I'm wondering if the tone of this campaign commercial, which is against Donald Trump, even though there's echoes of Barack Obama in this, if this the tone of this commercial helps these senators or actually makes them even more worried. Listen.
Life, marriage, religious liberty, the Second Amendment. We're just one Supreme Court justice away from losing them all.
Would President Trump ban partial birth abortion?
Well, look, I'm very pro-choice.
But you would not ban it?
No.
We cannot trust Donald Trump with these serious decisions.
If Ted Cruz turns this whole election into that kind of social issue campaign, does that work in the battleground states that you've just enumerated here with these senators up for grabs?
John, we're about to find out, because I think in many ways what you're seeing with the potential Supreme Court nomination in Ted Cruz is really analogous to the government shutdown fights of 2013, that the leadership of the Republican Party really didn't want. Ted Cruz forced their hand. What's the subtext? We need to get conservatives rallied behind us and get them out to vote. And now, if Ted Cruz's candidacy itself wasn't testing that theory, a Supreme Court fight tests it to the nth degree. Ted Cruz is really the one leading this charge that says we will not consider any Obama nominee, and not just in the primary. As you rightly point out, this is Cruz's theory for the general election. I don't need moderate voters. I don't need 6% in purple states. I'm going to rally evangelical and other conservatives to my cause. Blocking a nominee, making this race about the Supreme Court, conservatives have a long history of rallying right behind the importance of the Supreme Court and social and ideological issues there. But you have to look at the Democratic side too. And this fight, don't forget, it's Barack Obama who gets to choose the rallying point. The Senate may never confirm that person before the election, but Obama gets to choose who Democrats get to rally around and who Republicans have to fight against. And that's a risk for Ted Cruz.
But this could be a setup. We've only got 30 seconds. I mean, what if Barack Obama just nominates somebody who's kind of conservative and moderate?
And challenges the Senate to block that person,
right,
or chooses somebody who people can really rally around,
right,
and Democrats can make the point, hey, we're just trying to govern. This was Mitch McConnell's point the whole time. We can govern. Now that's getting upended. That's the risk involved in this. Mitch McConnell's message for the last year is, hey, we passed highway bills. We can govern. All of a sudden, we're not going to consider any nominees. That could be a huge advantage for a Democrat. And as it is on the Democratic side, a fight over electability and the importance of the court has to be advantage Hillary at this point, John. So you can see lots and lots of risks and benefits woven all through this thing.
High stakes. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
You bet, John.
Is there an independent judiciary in America today? The sudden death of Associate Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and the passionate debate about his replacement raises a question that he often asked in his talks with law students, that when judges make decisions that try to settle an unsettled political debate, then the judge becomes the target of political accountability. And hence, our Supreme Court and even our full federal judiciary has evolved in just a few decades into a collection of conservative and liberal fiefdoms where votes can be anticipated. At all levels, have we lost this idea of an independent judiciary? Have judges become an arm of the legislature? Are black robes suddenly blue and red? Justice Barbara Pariente is a Florida Supreme Court justice. She joins me now. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Justice Pariente.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
It seems that all of this debate and discussion, and some of it very, very inflamed and passionate, really raises the issue of a very old concept, and that is an independent judiciary. And I'm wondering if, with all this discussion of liberal, conservative, political accountability for judges, whether they vote in particular ways, if we've really lost sight of an independent judiciary at all level in the federal and state system.
I agree with you, and I deplore labels such as activist or conservative or liberal, because we do forget that the third branch of government, the judiciary, was designed to protect citizens against the excesses of power by the other two branches. And when we evaluate a judge by a label, we are really missing the point of our branch designed to be a non-political branch of government.
Yeah, one of the things Justice Scalia used to say, and I don't want to talk about his record, other than abstractly, he said that he was approved 98-0 in the Senate, and he doubts that he could even get approved today. And he claimed that if judges' decisions are going to preempt political issues, that therefore they're going to be politically accountable in battles like this in the Senate. Do you go along with that?
I think that perhaps there is truth to all of this, which is that we are seeing political rhetoric that has inflamed the other two branches coming into the third branch of government. And surely we do understand that with our founding fathers, they intended for the president to nominate and the Senate to confirm. So they must have envisioned there would be some political fighting. But once appointed, the judge is obligated to decide cases without regard to politics, the influence of special interests or public opinion polls. So there is a dichotomy there, a tension for sure, between the appointment process and the obligation of a judge or justice once he or she is appointed or elected, as it may be in the state court system.
Would you say that in issues like redistricting and even in Obamacare, if you look at the way in which the challenges have come to bear on the health care bill, that some in the Congress and some in legislatures at the state level view the judiciary as a kind of shadow legislature where they can kind of – they're not appealing a legal decision. They're basically going to a different window in the government to get a result that they like.
Well, that is the way those that don't like a decision play it. And that's what's so unfortunate. The phrase legislating from the bench has become one of the labels or phrases that is used for judges that interpret legislation. Conservative judge is a conservative judge, one that enforces or upholds the Fourth Amendment, or enforces and upholds the Second Amendment or the First Amendment. So you see, it really is admires the and confuses, I think, the issue. Our job is when we are presented with legislation that may be ambiguous, is to interpret the statute using standard rules of statutory construction. Somebody calls that legislating from the bench, that's really demeaning what goes on in a judicial decision. But what is critical is that you do not make a decision based on your personal opinion or on the public opinion polls. And that certainly was true at the time of Brown v. Board of Education. If the justices on that court had made a ruling based on popular opinion, they would have gone the opposite way. And if we had a federal judiciary that was subject to elections, we would have had judges that ruled that way removed from office.
How do you think all this political tension plays in situations where judges are actually elected and are held accountable by the fact that they have to stand for office?
The whole point is that we are trying to have judges that are insulated from politics. So in the federal judiciary, you have the protection of lifetime appointments. And that came as a result of one of the primary grievances in the Declaration of Independence. The king has made judges dependent on his will alone for the tenure of their offices. That was to say that he would remove judges who he disagreed with. In the state judiciary, Florida, for example, has a merit selection and retention system, and that system was passed to protect judges from politics. But special interests and dark money has indeed come to the third branch of government, and that's why we look to our citizens to hopefully remind them of the critical importance of having judges who render decisions based on the law and the facts and the Constitution, and not with fear that they're going to be removed from office if they render an opinion that's correct legally, but one that's not popular or one that's not what those in power would prefer.
Justice Barbara Pariente serves on the Florida Supreme Court. Justice, thank you so much for spending the time with us today.
Thank you.
The final battle for Aleppo in Syria may have begun.
It really is horrific, really, to be honest. I mean, we haven't seen this volume of attacks since the war began in a single day.
That's Juliet Tuma, regional spokesman for UNICEF, speaking to reporters on Monday about airstrikes in northern Syria that have destroyed healthcare facilities and schools, produced tens of thousands of refugees. A Doctors Without Borders hospital has been destroyed. 50 civilians have been killed. The attacks are happening in a window negotiated as part of a ceasefire, recently brokered by Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, a ceasefire supposed to take effect at the end of the week, long window. Senator John McCain says the Russians are just using this week-long window to take advantage of the ceasefire deal.
Mr. Putin is not interested in being our partner. He wants to shore up the Assad regime. He wants to reestablish Russia as a major power in the Middle East. He wants to use Syria as a live fire exercise for Russia's modernizing military.
But in the confused open season military environment in Syria right now, it has been difficult to confirm the source of these latest attacks Russia has been blamed, though that has yet to be confirmed, and the Russians are denying it. But there's no doubt that aid convoys promised in the ceasefire agreement have yet to arrive in Syria. Robert Ford served as U.S. ambassador to Syria from 2011 to 2014. He's also a fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Ambassador Ford, what do you make of this entire situation and this week-long window that has produced this escalation right after the ceasefire talks in Munich?
The Russians have been escalating their military operations in Syria for many weeks now, so they're just on a current escalation track. They have been explicit. They have been explicit that even after the so-called ceasefire were to come into effect, they will continue to bomb what they call our terrorists, and they say that any armed group in the Aleppo area, any armed group fighting the Syrian government are terrorists. So it's hard to see how there's going to be a cessation to Russian airstrikes, and therefore it's hard to see how there's going to be a ceasefire.
I don't understand what the U.S. tactical approach would be here, because Putin seems to be saying explicitly or implicitly that the way to fight ISIS is to reestablish the Assad government. Once we do that, then we'll go after ISIS. That violates a principle that the Obama administration has already said, that we want some kind of regime change in Damascus. And then what of all these other opposition groups that we're supposed to be arming and sending money to? If you listen to the Republican candidates, we've spent billions on people that now the Russians are going to destroy from airstrikes.
I'm not sure we've spent billions, but we certainly have provided arms and assistance to a few of the armed groups, including some that the Russians are now bombing in northern Syria. But we need to understand what the Russians want. What the Russians want is for the armed opposition to surrender to Bashar al-Assad's government. That's what they want. They have focused somewhere between 70 and 80% of their airstrikes not on the Islamic State, but rather on other rebel opposition groups. So the Russian target is clear. They want to get the armed opposition to quit the battle, to either surrender or just go away, go back into Turkey or something.
Is it possible that this is a decent strategy? I mean, nothing has worked so far against ISIS that the U.S. and the coalition has attempted to do. Maybe, you know, shifting gears and restoring Assad is the best way to fight ISIS.
I don't think the Syrian opposition is ever going to surrender. And we've had now 4 years where Bashar al-Assad could have mobilized enough Syrians to go fight the Islamic State, and he has failed to do so. He doesn't have enough people fighting for him. That's why Iran is organizing Shia militias from places like Iraq and Afghan refugee camps to go fight for Assad on the Syrian battlefield. Assad does not really have enough troops, doesn't have enough Syrian troops to go fight the Islamic State. So consolidating Bashar al-Assad in Damascus is one thing. Having enough troops to go fight the Islamic State is a different thing.
I don't know if you looked at the latest National Geographic magazine, but there are these outrageous pictures of the paradise that the Kurds have created in Erbil and in northern Iraq. And, of course, they're fighting, the Peshmerga is fighting in Syria to try to do the same thing in the Kurdish-controlled territories in Syria. Do the Kurds have the aspiration to create a kind of walled-off Kurdistan that would be basically separate from all of this other turmoil? Can they actually accomplish something like that?
Syrian Kurds, whom I've met over the years, look at the Kurdish experience in northern Iraq as a very positive experience. And I think they would like to create a similar autonomous zone. Iraqi Kurds are not fully independent, but let's say they're 85% independent. And I think Syrian Kurds on the Syrian side of the border up there in northeastern Syria, they too would like to be largely autonomous. Problem is that unlike Iraqi Kurdistan, the Syrian Kurdish areas are very heterogeneous. There are a lot of Arab tribes mixed in. There are a lot of Turkmen tribes mixed in. Even ancient Christian communities, Assyrian communities. It's not as homogeneous as it is on the Iraqi side of the border. And therefore, Syrian Kurds trying to set this up unilaterally without negotiating it with the other communities that live there with them is bound to cause ethnic and sectarian frictions.
Could that bring Turkey into a war that would have the Russians, a coalition, and now the Turks also trying to benefit the Sunnis inside Syria and fight ISIS or even support ISIS? We don't know what the Turks are up to.
Well, I don't think the Turks are supporting the Islamic State any longer. The Islamic State has carried out a number of terrorist operations inside Turkey and killed literally dozens and dozens of people in bombing attacks. But the Turks view the Kurdish issue as one that touches on their territorial integrity. That is to say, their literally their borders. They don't want Turkish Kurdish communities to link up politically with Syrian Kurdish communities. And so the Turks will be very involved in Syria, and they will be very careful about what the Syrian Kurds do.
Helping us to decipher the complex situation in Syria, Robert Ford, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ambassador Robert Ford is a former U.S. ambassador to Syria and a fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Can the first Latin American pope heal the world's second largest Catholic nation from decades of corruption, internal warfare, and murder? Pope Francis is in the middle of a six-day visit to Mexico, and expectations and crowd turnouts for Francis have been high. The pontiff has made some visits to some of the poorest and most violent places in Mexico, like the crime-ridden city of Ecatepec and San Cristobal de las Casas in Chiapas, the site of a major uprising in the 1990s. Does the pope's presence strengthen or weaken the current president, Enrique Peña Nieto's troubled administration? Frank Contreras is a correspondent with CCTV America. He's currently in Mexico City and joins us now. Which is it? Does Francis strengthen the government or weaken the government in some sense?
Well, he is definitely aiming some messages directly at Mexico's political elite, John. When he says things like, the kind of violence that's taking place, he knows it has to do with crime that's directly related to ongoing impunity here. And that's an issue that has plagued Mexico in large part because of corruption in the government government itself. And so, Mexico's elite is definitely keeping its head low and listening closely to what this Catholic leader is saying.
Is this message directed at the government? Listen, this is the Pope speaking over the weekend.
Earlier or later, the life of society becomes fertile soil for corruption, drug trafficking, the exclusion of different cultures, violence, which includes human trafficking, kidnapping, and death. That causes suffering and prevents development.
It sounds like the Pope is saying that the government is squeezing society to the point that corruption has a fertile bed to grow in, and that human trafficking becomes a necessity, and that exclusion of ethnic groups like down in Chiapas becomes the rationale for an uprising.
He's sending that message, remember, to a very large crowd of people outside of the Mexican capital in Ecatepec, as you mentioned. And this is an area, of course, that itself is suffering from daily crime in that area, people being robbed at gunpoint, kidnappings taking place, even small children being lifted and taken away by organized criminal groups in that part of Mexico. And so I think he's aiming this message not just at Mexico's political elite, but also at everyone, even among the lowest ranks of Mexican society, people who really feel like they're taking the brunt of this violence. Of course, as you know, more than 100,000 people have been killed in drug-related violence since Felipe Calderon, the president in 2006, declared war against drug trafficking organizations, John. And as well, tens of thousands of Mexicans have gone disappeared. And in that part of Mexico, they have really felt it quite a bit. I've spoken to families there who have lost little children and family members who have been, as I said, lifted off the streets by drug trafficking organizations who are seeking to gain money from kidnappings that take place in that part of Mexico. And so, this is, I think it's a message aimed definitely at the Mexican elite, the political class, who say they're trying to do something about the kind of violence that's been taking place, but and also to the rest of Mexican society that's just not feeling, you know, the solution coming quick enough.
Part of the folklore of organized crime in Mexico is that the folks at the top, the really rich drug lords, often pride themselves on their Catholic piety in their palatial mansions. Is there any chance that the hypocrisy of that will be trumped by the Pope's presence here, and that that message of corruption might even find its way into organized crime organizations and level some of this violence?
Well, you can bet that all members of Mexican society are listening very closely to what the Pope is saying. And as you say, yes, some of the major bosses in the drug trafficking industry, the illegal industry of moving methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine to the United States, they're definitely Catholic people who were baptized, people who received their first communion, people who knew the names of previous popes, Pope John Paul, who made four or five visits here to this highly Catholic nation. So all of these members of Mexican society are listening very, very carefully. Whether or not this actually seeps into the consciousness and changes the moral structure of people who are deciding to take these actions, that remains to be seen. There's always been a hope that a Catholic leader of this sort would come along. Again, this is the first Latin American pope speaking to Mexicans in their own Spanish language and giving them a sense that he really does kind of understand what they're living through. And so, yes, you know, you can imagine that there are drug traffickers probably in the distant highlands of Sinaloa State in the northern part of Mexico, and the so-called Golden Triangle, in the areas where Chapo Guzman, the leader of the Sinaloa cartel, those members of his drug trafficking organization also probably very likely listening to this message from the pontiff.
Do people think that the Pope has been brave in going into these places, that there's a certain amount of risk that he's taking, and his fearlessness is a message all by itself?
In a sense, yes, though people here in Mexico are very well aware that if he does go to a place like Ecatepec or to the highlands of Chiapas, San Cristobal de las Casas, or like he's going today to Morelia, these are all locations that, yes, have suffered from either violence or discrimination or different social problems that have created so much conflict in Mexico. But at the same time, it's the Pope. And so he is accompanied by a huge entourage of believers who work as a physical barrier, their bodies actually working to protect anybody who might try to come and reach the Pope to do harm. And then, of course, there is also Mexican Secret Service ordered by the presidency itself here in Mexico. And of course, the Vatican Nuncio has its own staff keeping a close eye. So, yes, the Pope is venturing into some places that no other Pope has ever visited, and people here do believe that he's being very brave for doing so. But he is not going to the most dangerous parts of Mexico, and he's not going alone. So this marks quite a difference.
Well, we'll see how the impact grows as this visit comes to a conclusion later this week. Frank Contreras is, of course, correspondent with CCTV America. Thanks so much, Frank.
I'm glad to be with you, John. Thank you.
Imagine people who can't see each other participating in a conversation. Well, that's like radio, you say, or just talking on the telephone, communicating on the internet. Well, here's the difference. Take away all of those means of communication. No talking. You have no idea who you are reaching out to. All you have is a mailing address from someone shut away in a dark room. What would someone like that say?
I've experienced times so difficult and felt boredom and loneliness to such a degree that it seemed to be a physical thing inside. So thick, it felt like it was choking me, trying to squeeze the sanity from my mind, the spirit from my soul, and the life from my body. I've seen and felt hope becoming like a foggy, ephemeral thing, hard to get a hold of, even harder to get a hold of as the years and then decades disappeared, while I stayed trapped in the emptiness of the shoe world.
The words of inmate Billy Blake from a letter read by someone on our staff currently in his 27th year of solitary confinement in the special housing unit, SHU for short, at the Elmira Correction Facility, as it's officially known, in upstate New York. Here's another voice.
I refuse to embrace the solitude. This is not normal. I'm not a monster and do not deserve to live in a concrete box. I am a man who has made mistakes, true, but I do not deserve to spend the rest of my life locked in a cage. What purpose does that serve? Why even waste the money to feed me? Why not just kill me? Our country has thousands of its people confined to concrete cages. Years pass, lives pass. The suffering does not. Our families suffer most, watching us grow old and go crazy in a cage. This is my biggest pain, knowing my mother and sister suffer with me.
It's a desperate-sounding letter from Jesse Wilson, who's serving time in ADX, the Supermax prison in Colorado, considered to be the most secure and isolating in the world. Jesse Wilson's words are read by Gene Casella. Casella, who along with longtime investigative reporter James Ridgway, have been collecting the letters of inmates from solitary confinement since 2009 through their organization, Solitary Watch. Ridgway says these communications, letters compiled into a newsletter, often serve as an inmate's only connection to the outside world.
Our project aimed at trying to figure out a way in which you could, you know, legally get a look inside so people could actually debate whether it was worth the trouble locking guys for 20 years in 6x9 cells. But it's very hard to get. It's very secret. So the only real way in which courts have let us do it is through the mail. Now, everyone says, you know, prisoners are liars. But most of the people I write to, I don't believe they're liars. Because there's a consistency to all these letters. I get 50 letters a week. And if you've been in the business, as you have and I have, for a length of time, you can sort of begin to tell what's for real and what isn't for real, you know. So you'll get these repeat descriptions of, let's say, the inability to get a shower, and then descriptions of what recreation really is, which is like a dog kennel a couple of times a week, and you can be let loose.
Gene, how did you understand the scale of the use of solitary through this project?
Well, when we began, we thought of it as the biggest domestic human rights crisis that no one had ever heard of. At the time, there was no sense of how many people were in solitary. There have been figures uncovered since then and some new studies done that reveal that the number is between 80 and 100,000 people on any given day are in some form of solitary confinement. So that's really a staggering number, even in a prison system that has 2.2 million people.
What is the feeling that you get from these letters of why these prisoners are reaching out? What kinds of motives do they have?
Well, a lot of the prisoners reach out very simply because they never talk to anybody. They don't see any humans. Just the idea that they might make contact with somebody in the outside world is a big deal for them. For example, people will sometimes ask us, could we have a picture? And you think, well, maybe they want a picture of the Acropolis or something, some famous thing. All they want a picture of is like a main street in some town. These guys haven't been out. Some of them, like one guy we write to a lot, has been in 27 years, solitary. Anyhow, they'll want a picture, and then the pictures are often seized as contraband. For example, the Oxford Book of World History had a map, I think, of the 16th century on the cover. That book was seized from somebody who wanted to read it because they thought it was an escape plan.
An escape plan.
An escape plan, yeah.
How many letters do you get a week?
Well, I get 50 letters about a week.
And you read them all?
Yeah, I mean, the letters are sort of like broken up. I mean, there's some letters that guys send that they want to be placed on our mailing list to get the newsletter. But there are others then that want help. And a lot of them go through their legal cases, you know, and we tell them, you know, we're not lawyers. We can't do anything. I'm sorry, but we can't do anything. Other ones talk about something maybe more complicated, like they have, there's one guy, he has glaucoma. I have glaucoma, so we write each other every so often, and he's had glaucoma, he says, for 2 years, and he hasn't been able to see a doctor. So he says, I'm getting blinder, you know, I'm getting blind. So I was mentioning this case to a social worker, And she said, oh, yeah, well, you know, you can't believe guys like that because he just wants you to write him up and then he thinks maybe he's going to get out. Well, see, if you're confronted by this kind of stuff from the social workers, what can you do? I mean, you're sort of like buffered from reaching out and asking for help. I mean, I get letters from people who want to commit suicide. I have to sort of like figure out, well, is this going to happen now or is this some future thing? And some of them clearly are about to happen. And in one or two cases, I've really tried to get into it and find some way of having somebody see this person.
What does that feel like?
I mean, I feel every day that, like, I can't stop this. You know, it's like a flow of water out of a pipe or something.
What do you hope to accomplish here?
Well, our project is very, very simple, and it aims at simply making public what goes on in solitary. But, of course, personally, I think we probably both agree that we would go sort of like the UN rapporteur. His thing is, I think...
15 days.
Yeah, 15 days in solitary. That would be the policy.
And that after that, it really rises to the level of torture or at least cruel, inhuman, and degrading punishment according to the definitions of the UN.
I always wonder, like, what about the judges? I mean, don't the judges ever wonder what happens to the people that they send away? And
I think the incredible dehumanization of people in prison is what allows this to continue in the same way that the dehumanization of African Americans allowed slavery to go on for so many years. And that someday we're going to look back and say, how could we have done this to human beings?
Well, James and Jean, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Thank you so much.
James Ridgway and Jean Casello are co-directors of Solitary Watch. Their book, authored with Sarah Shurd, is Hell is a Very Small Place, Voices from Solitary Confinement. It's out this month. To see pictures of the volume of letters they receive, and it's a sizable one, go to thetakeaway.org. Listen up, folks. The 140th annual Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show comes to an end tonight. We'll have the results tomorrow. Why don't you enlarge the kennel with a photo of your own dog with the proud hashtag Westminster Reject. Post the photo to our Facebook page or tweet us at The Takeaway. And while you're at it, jazz it up with some narration like those smug judges in the show. This mixed breed is an expert shedder and chews expensive Italian shoes. She's full of love and plays with dirty old tennis balls better than any purebred corgi. Email a voice memo to takeawaydigital@gmail.com because all good dogs deserve to be best in show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckleberry. This is The Takeaway.